The issue here is that do we believe the dominating narrative in the press at the moment on that first we built AGI and then after that those who built it won and then the rest of us just then have to survive, right? It's not obvious that it will go that way, and if it goes that way we might have some really serious side effects either before or after. So yeah, it would be nice to have diversity is my conclusion here.
Thank you for listening to Sprint, the podcast of the Federal Agency for Breakthrough Innovation of Germany. I'm Thomas Ramge, and for closing the year, I will take you to Copenhagen to the Europe's conference, the biggest scientific European conference on AI and ML. If you have listened to our last episode with Mirko Holzer and Johannes Otterbach, you know that we have kickstarted our huge AI Frontier Lab initiative at Europe's. I was as lucky to accompany the two of them to Copenhagen and took the opportunity to talk to a number of outstanding AI scientists on upcoming AI trends and challenges for the machine learning science community. In the following, you will hear from three brilliant human minds from Denmark, Finland, and Italy, starting with Søren Hauberg, professor for machine learning at the Technical University of Denmark, who has actually organized Europe's with over 1,500 participants. And we started our conversation by Zuring describing the atmosphere at Europe's.
So the other day, we had, during the poster sessions, we had a blackout. So like all the lights just went out in the poster session room. And what happened was that people just pulled out the smartphone from their pocket, turned on the flashlight, and continued the conversation. You didn't even, like, there wasn't even, like, a drop in the volume. People just, like, they were so into the actual science that they just, like, found a way to circumvent the blackout and just carry on. And I think that's very sort of saying of how much, like... how much the vibe means.
Very interesting. How, I mean, for most of our listeners of our audience, obviously are not machine learners. For non-machine learners, what are the most interesting technical trends that you've seen here that have been heavily discussed?
So, I mean, we've obviously seen a lot of methodology development. That's what these conferences are for. So it's we see a lot of stuff on diffusion models, generative models. So the diffusion models and related are the ones that drive all these image generative models that are all the craze, nano banana and what have you not. And we see a lot of like really fantastic developments on those. Then we also see these things that are more, you know, like 5 years into the future of product development, where we look at, you know, like the intrinsic mathematical structures of, say, transformer architectures. We had a great opening talk on that, where you sort of like find intrinsic redundancies in these models. And that's both useful for understanding what the heck these things are doing, which will be necessary for transparency and whatnot, but also like super important if you want to reduce model complexity. If you can somehow understand the intrinsic workings of the models we have, then we can much more easily trim them, thereby make them more power efficient and whatnot. And I think that's something we're seeing a lot. We also saw Sepp Hochreiter's keynote, where he sort of made a very compelling argument for why we can actually drastically cut energy usage of AI. And I think that's really important, especially sort of in the European context, where like American innovation is largely driven by, you know, just throw more compute at the problem, which is sort of a very, like, both expensive approach, but also environmentally unfriendly approach. And I think it's really sort of rewarding to see, you know, European lighthouse research really showing that there is an alternative path, and it's just as good in terms of, you know, raw predictive power, but in terms of, you know, all the other aspects of AI, energy usage, interpretability, and whatnot. Like, it's leaps and bounds ahead. And I think that to me is really striking, how, you know, how much we've been doing things in a very naive way by just throwing more compute at problems. And we're really seeing that, you know, we've more or less plateaued on that approach. And the next big challenge is how to do the same or better, but using like a tiny fraction of the resources. And this will also just make it like easier to enter this market if you don't have to buy a 100 billion euro cluster to get started. Like, if you can get away with a much smaller compute budget, then it's easier for smaller companies to get into the game.
That's very interesting. And I mean, you're basically describing right now two dimensions of innovation. So on the one hand, models are getting cheaper, smaller, you don't need as much data, and they get, as a consequence, much more eco-friendly, which fosters application and also, yeah, diversity of application. And then you said we are plateauing, and we are right now searching for basically the next step, the next frontier of getting the models better. What did you see here? What has been discussed on that level? Okay, they get smaller, they get more eco-friendly, but where's the next frontier in terms of, okay, they'll be more powerful as models themselves, and then can solve other problems than the large language models or the foundation models right now can solve?
That's a really good question. I don't think I've seen sort of what I consider to be like a compelling, here's the next approach. Honestly, I've mostly seen, and this goes sort of not just for this conference, but for the field as a whole, that we are still sort of scrambling on how to get like to the next step of performance. There are people like Jan LeCun arguing that we need to, you know, model the world in its entirety, and then people debate what does that even mean. And I think that's like that's a reasonable thing to explore. It's still some years out there into the future, which is great. I'm a researcher. I love, you know, looking way ahead. But I think it's still too early to tell if that's the viable approach, or we need to, you know, build models that are physically explicit, meaning, you know, modeling laws of nature and whatnot. But all that will depend very much on the context. And honestly, I think, like, people seem to generally like correlate AI with language models. So these chat bots and whatnot, that's what people call AI. And I think the next major step is to like drop that mentality. Like, I don't think we're going to see massive like performance boosts in these language models. They are doing quite well, and they haven't really changed in the last couple of years. So I think the next sort of frontier is like actually changing domains. So like putting this into the use of like other branches of science is where we're going to see the next major breakthroughs. So in material design, in you know, molecular development, you want to develop new drugs, you want to develop new battery techniques, you want to whatnot. You want to build better food preservatives, or, and all these things. And I think that's where the like the next frontier actually is. It's less exciting because we're all caught up in this, ooh, are they artificially generally intelligent and whatnot? And I think that discussion is sort of standing in the way of the next frontier, which is really like letting AI advance the like the fields that actually matter. So, you know, I want to see better batteries. I want to see, you know, more efficient drugs. I want to see, you know, that we can build green infrastructure more efficiently and, you know, more intelligent power grids and whatnot. And I think that's where the real frontier of AI is these days, but it's getting much less attention.
That's so interesting. Okay, let's assume you're a scientist. I mean, we feel it, we see it. Just if you were an investor, what's the next alpha fold you would invest in? So something strong, powerful AI infused in a certain scientific field where it solves something that is really important, in the case of alpha fold, protein folding, and then basically changes a whole field, industry, field of science. So what's your bet?
Ooh, that's a tough one. Like Cusp AI is doing really marvelous stuff. That's this company founded by, amongst other, Max Welling. They're doing amazing stuff in material science where they can really help, you know, suck out things like PFAS from the groundwater and other things. They can help you, you know, extract CO2 from the atmosphere and that type of companies. That's where, like, I see there's a major thing going on there. I would also be on the lookout for, you know, you mentioned AlphaFold as like the next thing, but there is like a bunch of companies basically building on top of what was done with AlphaFold to now do better drug design, to do better medicine. There's like massive breakthroughs in things like, you know, snake venom treatment, where all of this is AI driven. And I think there we're just scratching the surface. So if I had money, you mentioned I'm a scientist, that means I don't have money. But if I had money, that's where I would invest.
Interesting. Well, Cusp would be too late now, I guess.
Indeed.
Last question. What kind of AI application would you wish for, greenfield wishful thinking, in the year 2050, so 25 years from now? What kind of AI would you like to see in the world?
I don't think I want to see AI in the world. Like, I think I want to see that AI is, you know, just yet another boring tool that is like integrated in our, you know, daily workflow of solving other problems. Like, I'm not sold on this general model of now I have like a, you know, artificial secretary or something. Like, I see that as a neat way of interacting with a computer, but nothing more. I don't think it's that exciting. I think it's way more exciting to build models for scientific discovery, such as what we talked about before with, you know, we want to discover new proteins or new materials and whatnot. I think, to me, if we can nail that, like, imagine the possibilities if you can basically have like a chat interface, but to the world of materials or to the world of molecules. And sort of say, hey, I need a molecule that's really good at cleansing clothes, but it's still very like preserving on, say, wool. Then, like, you know, then we drastically reduce, you know, the waste of, you know, our clothes being torn up in the washing machine and whatnot. All these sort of low pragmatic things. I think that's where we want to go. We want to make AI boring. We want it to sort of be part of the tool development and part of, you know, developing all the real things that matter. AI in itself doesn't matter. It's just a tool to get us to somewhere interesting. So I somehow, like, I'm just not that convinced by this idea that, you know, we're going to see great new AI apps. No, AI apps needs to go away. They need to disappear, fade into the background. And that's where they'll be really great.
It's so great to talk to someone who is unhyping something which is so exciting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The second conversation I want to share with you is with Samuel Kaski, the founding director of the Ellis Institute Finland, who is also a double professor at the universities of Aalto in Finland and Manchester in the UK. We dive into the conversation where Sami is reflecting on the current innovation trends in AI.
Let me pick up two things that stuck to my mind, and I was aware of both of those beforehand, but now hopefully more people it caught more people's attention. So one was the Mike Jordan's talk, and I very much liked that view. He was emphasizing very much that the world is not only LLMs, and I would even add that the world is not only foundation models. The current maybe megatrend, I may be misphrasing what he meant, I'm kind of interpreting it from my own angle, is that the ultimately all of these systems will be used by people in an ecosystem. And now we will not really understand what is the problem that the system should solve without putting also the economics principle there, which would be called the, of course, game theory, or then the kind of reverse of game theory, which is called mechanism design. And putting those kinds of problems in there, which is now expanding the horizon a bit, but not too much. It's still kind of addressable, and he had a couple of really nice thoughts there. I would maybe even go one step further and say that we seem to be very good at producing side effects with our technology. And now, as a scientist, of course, I can argue that it's not my fault, right? Because the side effects come when we actually deploy them. But it certainly is Big Tech's fault. And of course, many of us contribute to Big Tech as well. So in that sense, it is also our fault. So kind of putting in, if we would be able to put in also other aspects of kind of understanding so groups of people and societies, or even individual people, starting from cognitive science or psychology in those systems, in addition to economics, that would be a really, really nice direction. And many of us are thinking along those directions, but then it, of course, gets more complicated and it's more difficult to solve them with quick and dirty tricks. The other one is maybe closer to for somebody who would want to hear what is happening in EURIBS, and EURIBS is probably, they would be thinking of the big foundation models and so on. And of course, they have very good uses and are very important. Is the more efficient versions, maybe less energy, less data, and so on, and how close can we get? So Sepp Hochreiter gave a really nice keynote on this. So he has a couple of nice thoughts there.
It would be less money as well, which would obviously make many things easier for actors who are not big tech, who don't have these very deep pockets.
Absolutely, and it certainly wouldn't hurt to have a bit more diversity in the ecosystem. Because apparently we can't have antitrust laws global, which would really be effective here. But I think that especially for Europe, this is really important that we don't just have 3 to 7 big tech companies determining what happens in machine learning and in our future with machine learning.
I mean, that has always been a sort of underlying message here in many talks, that everything we do here in terms of smaller models, less data, more energy efficiency, in the end sort of counts for tech sovereignty. Could you expand a little bit on that? Is that a realistic view on it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, there will certainly be problems where having more data, or you could argue that almost all problems, if you have more data and more compute, you will be able to solve them better. But on the other hand, you may not be able to solve all of the problem, kind of the mass of different kinds of problems. I mean, the world is really full of problems, and we are not tackling them yet because we don't have the diversity, and people seem to be focusing on the same problems, which is a bit a problem in the hype driven industry that we are partially in. I mean, of course, most real scientists are not thinking in this sense. So there will be lots of problems which can be solved, maybe well enough, maybe really well with smaller models. And now I think it is really, the issue here is that do we believe the dominating narrative in the press at the moment on that first we build AGI, and then after that, those who build it won, and then the rest of us just then have to survive, right? It's not obvious that it will go that way, and if it goes that way, we might have some really serious side effects either before or after. So yeah, it would be nice to have diversity is my conclusion here.
Isn't it funny that the term AGI basically never came up during this conference? And can you tell us why?
That's funny. I think Mike Jordan made a point of it that he mentioned it only once and in a very negative sense. I don't know more than you on why not. So, but the... not all researchers are buying into that narrative, and it may now be a biased sample, or then it may be that it really is representing the what you now said is representing how the community in general thinks.
What has to happen? That what you've described before, if I understood you correctly, that the infusion of the technology that we have now into application fields where they have not been deployed yet. What has to happen that this process, may it be in biomedicine, may it be in material science, may it be in energy science, what has to happen that this now science wish becomes true?
You mean that it actually becomes deployed more more broadly?
Very good question. So now I think most of us scientists are really looking for the next important problem that is not solved yet, and which would be, I actually
would like to think that we are thinking of the betterment of humanity and are trying to find problems that would be important to solve in that sense, that it would be for the common good. And of course, it can have business benefits as well, and they may not be contradictory. So, kind of the science community is big enough that if we as science community do our work really well and really are aiming at finding different problems, and if the funding landscape also supports that, we will be able to solve many of these problems with the next generations of technologies which all of us scientists are developing all the time. So that is already happening. Now the big question is maybe that kind of is this the more efficient route than is the more efficient route the what big tech is pursuing now? And we don't have an answer to that yet.
You're a scientist, you're not an investor. But if you had a lot of money to invest to solve one problem, one big problem, alpha fold style, so protein folding, what would you bet on?
Well, I'm that much of a maverick that I would always try to shake the rules here. So that's what I'm trying to do right now. I mean, isn't the diversification is the real issue, what you would do when you do? I mean, that's the only thing I know about investing, is that you would, of course, want to consider making the risk tolerable by diversifying.
Okay, I give you three shots now. Okay, but that's as much diversification as you... If you have this, I'm still giving it in this game of thought.
Yeah. Let me check the system radically. I would set up a fund that is maximally diversifying, because I think that way we would identify the important problem. Maybe that's the one answer to you. But okay, I understand what you're asking. But I'm actually serious about that, because that is what the science system is doing. It's doing exactly that. I mean, sometimes not efficiently, and people just focus. But we are, after all, people, of course, all scientists. So the people would be stagnated to some of choosing a few pet projects instead of diversifying sufficiently. But I mean, That's how I understand what the system is for, that we would identify those problems that we didn't realize are actually the better ones than what we thought so far. So yeah, I would do everything I can to push towards that direction if I had a massive amount of money to invest. But yeah, if I can't do that, that's what you are asking. Okay, so three things. I'll pick one where I know that big action is already happening: designing of new materials. And there is a really strong European startup, lots of things happening elsewhere as well. So I wouldn't have anything really grandiose new there, but as an investor, probably that would like look like a really good opportunity. Then going a bit to the side of that, it would be kind of biomaterials. So designing cellular factories that would produce also materials that we can't initial design with other like chemistry techniques and so on. Yeah, this would be a really big thing because now we can also have multi-objective optimization and try to also reduce energy use and maybe even capture carbon as we do this. And these seem like a really, really good opportunities. Okay, so then the third one. Yeah, I would say actually cognitive and societal technologies in the sense that we would put in first of all, we would put in cognitive scientific insights into our systems so that they work really well with people, and then societal, starting from, say, groups of experts in helping in decision-making in groups. And putting in prior knowledge from what we know about how people work, and then learning the rest with the techniques that we have. Yeah, these directions. Yeah, I actually believe in these ones.
Makes total sense.
Sorry for being evasive. Yeah.
The next question you cannot erase because that is pure wishful thinking. So that's basically the child's mindset, when Christmas is coming, but Christmas is coming for you now in the year 2050. And you can, for your personal life or your loved ones, wish for one application associated with AI that will make your life better, your family life better. So what sort of single helpful AI application would you wish for in the year 2050?
Yeah, I realize that I'm again evading probably your answer, it would be carbon capture technologies. Yeah, we wouldn't directly, if that's successful, we wouldn't have a nice Christmas present, but the world would be a really much better place.
Will AI play a role in it?
It would, yes, definitely. On how do you design that system so that it actually works and doesn't produce side effects, yes.
Sami, thank you so much for this great interview and for the time.
Thanks for inviting.
And the third AI researcher I talked to was Lorenzo Rosasco, who is professor for machine learning at the University of Genova. And you will realize Lorenzo has quite an ambivalent perspective on the speed and of the direction of current AI innovation.
Well, I think in terms of AI, maybe it's a little hard to say. We're definitely on the rise in terms of still discovering applicability of technologies that are already available. I feel like, you know, there is still a long way to go in making take full advantage of what we have right now.
What are possible fields you would identify as possibly or even likely that might come the next leap from?
I don't know. Again, as I was mentioning, so my view is a bit from a theory perspective. So I'm curious to see where foundational work will be able to somewhat provide the most return over investment. And I would say somewhat application in science seems to be particularly interesting, you know, where there could be a real breakthrough in the next few years. You know, climate science, for example, is an example where one could really take advantage of data. But there are, again, many, many other fields. AlphaFold was an example, but I think that's a very interesting direction.
Okay, you're being a theorist, but if you were an investor, what would you put your money on right now?
I don't know, because again, I think laterally, right? You know, I think more or less everybody's going for the same thing. So I would either think long term, and again, for example, you know, application in science would be what I would bet my money on, because I think it's going to take a bit longer, but the outcomes could be great, or more like immediate, you know, products, small products that can be done right now. I think there are plenty, you know. Most companies seems to be investing in AI without really knowing what it could be useful for. I think, you know, it's hard now to stay in the race with the big players that are playing the game.
what kind of possible leaps within the models in itself, not talking about the applications, might lie ahead. I mean, here at Europe, there's been a lot of talk about working with less data, working with less compute, basically smaller models. Is that something you consider to be realistic or likely?
Yeah, I think it's quite likely. I think right now the incentive was just to make it bigger and win the race. But right now, I think, you know, making the model smaller, it's interesting. And also it's like what a lot of people can do. So it might be also a big shift could be that the moment the models are small, then we're back to an open world where a lot of actors can take, you know, initiatives and do stuff, which I think what's really, really missing now. So I think, I believe it's going to happen.
You, as being someone who obviously knows the US very well, Europe very well, I mean, there's always right now the story Europeans tell themselves that, we have the talent, we have the knowledge, and it's only about turning science into applications where we're behind. Is that a story which has substance?
No, I don't think so. It's very myopic. I think, innovation in the US is not happening because you turn, science into applications, but that's because you look a bit more, you know, far ahead. I think right now there is this sense that we have some, otherwise we keep on just buying technologies that has been done somewhere else. We have to do real innovation, which is, you know, new stuff, new ideas, new push the frontiers. I think right now, at least, you know, in Italy, they're a little bit better. We're just chasing, you know, just thinking about using a technology and just trying to import something in a somewhat limited context. I think we really have to push the frontier, and this is not really happening.
How could we do it?
Well, we need initiatives that somewhat are connecting people, creating momentum. We need investors that are willing to take risks and not just super short-term views on returns. And that's what's happening all the time in the US. You know, you start something, you chase a dream, and then you see if it goes. Otherwise, you clip it after a few years and you start another one. And I don't think that's really happening in Europe as much, or it's kind of scattered around in the small initiatives.
If you look at your students and PhD in Genova, do you see the change of mindset? Or could you even say that, well, the ones with the entrepreneurial mindset migrate to the US anyways?
Well, I'm not sure. I think the big difference is that the US is hard to say, but, you know, I spent time in the East Coast, and I think that's a very tangible opportunity and possibility that everybody has in mind, you know, a startup. I don't think in Europe is as tangible. It's not as concrete possibility. It's a bit more remote. I think the typical PhD student is more starting to, you know, has more academia vibe in mind. So there is a huge difference. I feel like we're not there yet. Few people are thinking about it, but they're really few compared to the US, where I think it's more or less an option on the table all the time.
What could help these young, brilliant AI minds to get more into an entrepreneurial mindset?
Well, again, concrete possibilities, you know, knowing that, for example, you have access to real investments that can boost up your possibilities. I feel like that's, I don't know the situation all over Europe, but certainly in Italy, the propension to investment is not there. I mean, you kind of have to, you know, before you see any money, you really have to work a lot for free for a long time, which I don't think is conceivable anymore. So, ideas, I think, might be there. But the investment seems to be, at least in Italy, what's really lacking. In the rest of Europe, I think some places a little bit better. But overall, and also, you know, clearly the fact that the US is one big country. Europe is a collection of different countries, different languages, different connections, different networks. So that's a huge difference. So investment seems to be a huge issue.
Sure. Sorry for jumping on aspects, but I mean, we see all this beauty of the models and how good they work and how impressive is what they do. And then at least in comparison to that, productivity growth, thanks to AI, is rather small. What's your explanation for that?
So I don't really know. My educated guess right now is mostly that we set the expectation of, I think if you think of AI as a very good research engine and you use it as such, and then you measure, you know, how much it speeds up your work, you'll see pretty good results. But right now, I think the fact that somewhat we had this idea, there is, you know, especially people that don't know much about AI, just think that there is AI, that there is a form of intelligence that you can talk to and it's going to do amazing stuff. And then you set the expectations so high, and then you spend a lot of time figuring out what it actually can do for you. So I think right now, as I said, there is a lot of expectation it's going to do more than what you can do right now. I think we're still figuring out how to use it and how to explain people how to use it on an everyday, you know, to increase their everyday productivity. And to me, the mismatch between what it really does and the expectation is one of the big reasons of confusion and you know, both in approaching AI and evaluating the effect of AI and so on and so forth. I think if you just think about it as a, you know, research engine plus, you know, text editor plus, it's pretty good. You know, it makes you much faster, right? Bureaucracy goes much faster. You know, proofreading is much faster. There's small things, but, you know, you save a lot of time every day. And I think that's the main thing, really.
Plus the aspect of knowledge discovery, I think that's totally underrated. In the sense that, I mean, how much easier the access to knowledge has become thanks to the models. And that's something that is totally underrated.
Would you agree?
I think it's becoming more and more obvious, but yeah. I think, there is a bit of, you know, one, right, to take it easy because somewhat you still have to double check everything. You know, you cannot really trust the sources. You assume, you know, it could be partial, but absolutely, you know, there's something you don't know about. Rather than spending like 3 days of research, you just spend half an hour and you can get a glimpse of what's going on. And that's new. I think that's a huge, huge, you know, boost. But this is the kind of stuff that you can do, right? I think if this was our expectation, we just look at that, we're like, yeah, oh, absolutely, it's amazing. But now we're thinking about, oh, we're going to have an AI that's going to, you know, replace a person. Yeah, I'm not sure. What is a job that could be completely replaced by AI right now? I mean, what are the examples that were not there already, you know, in the last 5-10 years? Because we know that, for example, translation is an example of it, but it did not happen in the last year. It happened like last 10 years. So yeah, I'm not sure. I'm really curious, whenever people talk about, you know, AI replacing jobs, I'm still trying to figure out where are these big portion sectors where this is going to happen. I'm still trying to figure it out.
Everybody does. Last question. If you had one wish, what kind of application within AI you want to have in the year 2050? So 25 years from now, what would they like to have? What problem should have AI solved for you personally, for society, for the planet? One wish.
Well, I think, I was reading... We did an article just this weekend that was somewhat pointing out that we need a better way to share, resources, you know, somewhat in the last few years between, the working class and the educated college people, there has been somewhat, a separation, and a few people are extremely rich, whereas many people don't have the same means. And I think that would be the really one thing that it's much needed right now, a way, for example, to have AI working with jobs, you know, to have more jobs, better paid jobs, better workers, more instructed people. I think that's what we need it for, you know, somewhat turn the wheel completely and make AI positive as a work enabler rather than work, you know, taking away jobs. And I think that would be, if AI allows to somewhat share resources rather than concentrate resource in the end of few, that would be, you know, that my dream come true in for 2050, I guess.
And this was it, not only for our special episode from Copenhagen, but for the whole year. Thank you for being a regular listener in 2025. We, the podcast team at Sprint, we wish you a Merry Christmas and a jumpstart into 2026. The Sprint podcast takes now a short break, and we will be back with our next episode then end of January, in which our director, Rafael Laguna de la Vera, will give us an update and an outlook on all things going on at Sprint in the upcoming year. Thanks again for listening, and please remember, also for the next year, stay curious.